Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Well, in this very internet savvy age, here's a question. How do you have debates, discussions if you like, that are disagreeable while not becoming over the top and shouty or even worse? A couple of studies that we wanted to look at this week. One that tells us where the majority of those really ugly, racist memes come from, and another that talks about how crowds change their opinion and flip from one norm to the other. We wanted to discuss both of those with one of our favourite philosophers. He's Professor Colin Klein. Colin is from the ANU's School of Philosophy.
Thanks for having me.
We're having a look at this study of memes, but can we start out by kind of describing exactly what a meme is and thinking a little bit about how the meme culture has developed pretty rapidly in the last, decade, is probably 5 years.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, historically, the idea of a meme comes actually from some fairly hard science, scientists. So Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett kind of popularized the term. The idea was just as you might have genes which spread throughout a population in this kind of Darwinian way, you might have memes, which are ideas that spread around. And there was a lot of discussion about this initially and, kind of in academia, but the term has gone over to kind of bits of the internet that, as it were, go viral or become self-propagating. And by and large, these involve when people talk about memes these days, they involve usually captioned pictures with some sort of, depending on your sense of humor, humorous content.
So a picture itself might become a meme in the sense that it's a graphic image that's used by people to convey their emotions, but over the top of that picture, people are likely to write their own captions. So you end up with pictures being used for multiple messages, and a great example of that is Pepe the Frog.
Ah, yes. Yeah, so you've got the same picture, and then, depending on the emotion, people put different things on. And then there's this case of Pepe the Frog, which is a kind of crudely drawn, sad-looking frog, although I think he shows different emotions, has become something of a kind of alt-right, kind of racist meme, I think much to the dismay of Pepe's creator.
Yes.
A lot of these things, they get taken out of context and then appropriated in various other ways.
Well, as I recall it, this was just a comic strip that was drawn for some other purpose, just to entertain people, whatever. Or maybe he had things to say of his own. But now this frog picture appears in a lot of, as you said, alt-right, quite very far-right, often very racist, sometimes anti-Semitic sort of material. And so the frog, that frog symbol now means something that the original drawer never intended.
Yeah, and I mean, in fact, I think that Pepe has taken this, in particular, has taken this on so much that it just kind of become a symbol of racism. So it's not used by people unless they want to convey something, fairly extreme on the right wing.
Yes, you wouldn't be putting, I just feel for some unwitting person putting up Pepe the Frog. It's not easy being green. Well, hang on a minute. What have you got against green people?
Yes, I'm sure occasionally some like misguided corporation uses this without realizing.
Well, it's interesting. So there's a study that you've been looking into that sort of shows how these things propagate around the net. They seem to come out of a few different places. So the internet is developing locations. Those locations are places like Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, whole communities of people that tend to, despite the disorganized nature of the net, to sort of find their community in a
subreddits or image boards.
Yes. Yeah, people find their level, and sometimes it's fairly low level.
Yeah, and so some of these. I mean, so there was a recent study coming out of Cyprus University of Technology and University College London, looking at kind of where some of these memes come from, because I think for most people, including me, you kind of start seeing them around the web and you have no idea. And some of them, these are communities like Reddit that I think, some people are familiar with and have, large legitimate communities on them. And then some of the communities are kind of more fringy, you might think, or YouTube. There's one called 4chan that I think people may be less familiar with. It's the kind of, we call it the howling void of the internet, but it's this. It's completely anonymous, mostly image based. They don't moderate it particularly well. So Reddit, although there's variation, there are also moderators who will try to at least tone down especially explicitly racist things. So in some sense, it's the sort of purest free speech place on the internet with all of the negative things that entails. So a lot of these things kind of get kicked around in 4chan and then, or created there and then move over, particularly the more racist, more kind of hate speech ones, and then move over to broader platforms like YouTube or Reddit or Tumblr, things like that. So it's interesting in the sense that you can have these smaller, more extreme communities, and then there's a kind of crossover into more general communities that people see.
What fascinates me about that is the idea that somebody in 4chan creates a meme which is pretty offensive, and it sort of kicks around in there for a little while with people just sharing it on 4chan itself or amongst themselves. Then one person it would be, or it might be two or three, but, you know, a small number of individuals then post it into a different platform. Let's call it, you know, let's say they post it into Facebook. And then others who are not part of the 4chan neighbourhood, they start reposting in Facebook, and it meets a whole bunch of new audiences. But what's happened there is the whole notion of what's acceptable in Facebook starts to change.
Yeah, so, I mean, eventually... Right, so what you get, and you imagine there's a bit of a filter in that, you know, on Facebook, if you post something extremely racist, it won't, you know, it'll get moderated down.
Yes, thank goodness.
People report
yes.
it. But you can kind of push the boundaries there. There's going to be things that are, you know, offensive, but, you know, not enough to trigger filters, not enough to trigger moderation. And I think in some of the ways, over time, you start, as it were, dragging the level of discourse one direction or another. And I should mention, you know, although we're kind of picking on alt-right racist themes, you also get left-wing versions of this as well that we've seen. In fact, it's an interesting, some things like the anti-vaccination movement don't seem to have, you know, particular political affiliation, but you still get a kind of pull regardless. There was another study, I wouldn't have mentioned this because it was just an article in The Guardian about this that's really fascinating. About a man who was part of the incel movement. I don't know if you're familiar with that. This is a kind of aggressively misogynist movement online, and some of the recent mass shootings in the U.S. And in Canada have been linked to people who feel, you know, particularly embittered about women and have gotten support from these. And he had left that community, and really interestingly said, yeah, I kind of thought we were, you know, it was all a bit of a joke, like we were all just blowing off steam. And
really?
Clearly not. And he's like, and then I say this online, I get a lot of messages from people saying, no, I'm really serious about this. So I think there's something about, and I think something about memes with this is really interesting too, because they're almost always presented as jokes. And this is fine line about, like, I think some people think, oh, yeah, you know, this is kind of funny, even if they're, you know, again, they have kind of poor taste in humor. But it's that humor that kind of slips them past and gets them around.
Yes. So there's a discussion there, I think, around what develops acceptability within certain circles. We know we can behave this way at work. We behave this way at our church community. We behave this way when we're amongst friends just kicking around a football on a Sunday, whatever it is, there are some kind of social rules. And it's fascinating to start to think about the internet, which is still now only 20 years old, let's say, and social media, which is really not more than, I would think, 10 to 15 years old, to start thinking about the ways in which it's developing these communities of practice, neighbourhoods, do you think?
Yes. I mean, there was another recent study that we had up on there that just came out in Science. It was really fascinating about this idea of a tipping point. This is, again, coming out of, University of Pennsylvania and also University College London. So sociologists, again, have often had this idea that if you get a very committed minority of people, that's often enough, and then a kind of more indifferent majority of people, as long as that minority is loud enough and kind of persistent enough, you can actually get them to tip norms around. So, I mean, you find really interesting cases of this, just to go, again, to the other end of the political spectrum, something like norms around gay marriage, which I remember, you know, I'm old enough that I remember, say, 15, 20 years ago, it was the idea that you would have gay marriage was quite an extreme position in many ways. But you had people who were quite committed to it, and I think you had a large number of people who thought, even if they were against it, not particularly, you know, extreme about it. And so what happens is if you've got this committed minority at some point, what was striking to me about gay marriage is it felt like within a few years it flipped over from everyone thinking that this was, you know, chilly to, you know, having, you know, quite quickly.
Well, very strong views about it, and even something that wasn't happening 15 years ago when you might have had a discussion about it, you then start getting the denunciation of people who might hold a different view, which is probably one of the signs that you've reached a tipping point when the majority starts now picking on people with a different view.
Yeah, and yeah, the idea that all of a sudden it becomes, as it were, not just the held opinion, but a new norm. And again, how rapidly that can happen.
How did this study shed light on the tipping point issue?
What they did was actually just have people in a lab playing the game and all trying to coordinate essentially on picking the same name for somebody.
Oh, yeah.
And what they showed is, you know, about as long as you had about, and people, if you don't have anything, but like people are quite good at this, they just, essentially what happens is you get a bunch of people randomly picking names, and then people remember what names were popular in the previous round, and they start converging on them. So essentially, if you're just trying to pick something that everyone is already doing, people are pretty good at that. And then they had a very committed minority who essentially, you know, wouldn't change their choice.
Yes.
They all pump in for one name.
Yes.
They found that once that size got up to about 25%, somewhere between 20 and 25%, they were enough to really drive it. So drive everyone to their preferred choice. Partly because people were just, you know, you imagine if you're just trying to coordinate and all pick the same name for, you know, in this game, and you keep hearing the same name over and over again, you think in some sense, well, everyone else is hearing this too. If I'm just trying to coordinate on a shared solution, that starts becoming more and more attractive. As a philosopher, it's interesting to me. I think a lot of our opinions, even about what's right and what's right to do, are taken more from the community than at least philosophers would like to think.
Yes.
I mean, philosophers would like to think everyone sits around and thinks quite deeply about what the moral, what the nature of the good and what, you know, is it. But I think most of the time we think, well, you know, no one around me steals office supplies. I guess stealing office supplies is probably bad. And if everyone around me starts stealing office supplies, I'll probably start thinking, well, I don't know, I could use some pens.
Well, I mean, yeah, so the word you're looking for is culture, and that's absolutely right. It does in workplaces and in society itself. Does that mean, then, that it's really important? Because I know a lot of people who just get tired of these angst-ridden debates on the internet, but are you saying surely not that it's important to go in and have a crack at those who are having a go at you?
Yeah, it's a tricky part because I've struggled with this. You know, I get through various periods where I say, look, I'm not going to have political debates on Facebook, and I'm much happier for it. I think one thing that's important, even when it's difficult, there might be a counterbalance to this, is to say, well, you know, even if you don't want to fight, even just saying, look, I don't agree, or in other words, you know, speaking up when there's something wrong, when you think there's something wrong against the norm. Because if a lot of what people are doing is try to gauge what other people think, then in some sense, you know, remaining silent lets people, you know, lets a small minority more effectively gain a foothold. But finding kind of respectful ways just to say, well, look, you know, I disagree, you know, you might think at least other people around you can more effectively calibrate what's going on, you know, what the majority thinks.
I completely agree with you. I think we do need to learn how to disagree. I heard a talk last year at the Kew Commons event, actually, by Senator Lucy Gishui, who's been in the news a bit recently. She's moved to the Liberal Party, you might know, but she actually said people need to learn to disagree agreeably. I thought, what a beautiful way of expressing it.
It is. I mean, it's a really hard switch. You know, I've got one friend on Facebook.
You've got one friend on Facebook? Oh, sorry.
No, I was going to say.
Of your many friends on Facebook. Sorry, I was worried about you there, Colin.
Of my many friends on Facebook, there's one of them who has friends on kind of both sides of the political spectrum and is very good at like kind of encouraging thoughtful debate and, you know, calming people down. And, you know, you can get to these spaces where everyone calms down a little bit and feels like they can, you know, feels like they can say what they think. And it's really amazing, but it's also really striking to me that, you know, there's one friend who does this, and it's pretty rare even that. I think trying to find a way to make those spaces legitimately. So this comes up, obviously, I'm a professor, like the idea that there could be good space for debate comes up a lot here. And it's really tricky because what you don't want is like, you know, you don't want someone to say, well, we need a safe space for debate so then people can find out why they're wrong. it's really got to be legitimately open. But I think even then, even stepping back from debate, there is this kind of weariness that you get where you don't want to fight. And then it starts becoming, you know, you start thinking like everyone believes this because it's just too much trouble to, you know, say anything else. Mm. And so it can be hard to, and then everyone kind of thinks, everyone thinks it. I mean, I actually worry about this with gay marriage because I think there are a lot of people who went along, you know, there are certain things that, you know, I consider social gains that I actually think are more precarious. And you look at what's going on in the U.S. right now, lots of things I think people thought we all agreed on. In fact, most people didn't really agree on, they just thought everyone else did. And it only, you know, you get these things that look like gains, but you can very quickly switch over to everyone saying, oh, wait, I guess we are, you know, or lots of people saying, actually, you know, I wasn't behind that all along. And now that I know everyone else is not, let's step back a second.
Very insightful indeed. Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Well, it's been marvellous chatting through with you these issues about shifting cultural norms and just chatting philosophy and sociology. Colin Klein, always good. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks again for having me.
Colin Klein from the Australian National University's School of Philosophy. He's a professor there of philosophy. And I tell you, here's something interesting in the disagreeing agreeably stakes. I always get that the wrong way around. Maybe it's my DNA. But you know what Paul says about our nature. We have to fight against our nature. Anyway, artificial intelligence is now debating people. Yes. You know how IBM had... Big Blue was just the machine. Yeah, it was Big Blue that won the chess championship against Deep Blue, won the championship against Garry Kasparov. Well, their latest project is called Project Debater. And this is an artificial intelligence machine that can debate human beings. And in the last week gone by, using their revolutionary speech writing and artificial intelligence technology, the Project Debater computer won the audience vote for the most persuasive debate in one of two debates held at IBM's headquarters. So there you go. You might not even know if you're debating a human being anymore, and you might be losing. We will not have them on the show next week. Settle.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.